All right. So when certainly when I first started meditating, which was well over 25 years ago, when I came to meditation, it seemed like I understood that I needed it because there was an enormous amount of mental agitation going on in my life. But on the other hand, I was a very socially engaged person in terms of both politics and my relationship to what I thought was important activities. And I sort of thought that, well, I know meditation is important. I grew up in a Buddhist family, and I knew that it would help me, but I didn't really see, quite honestly, the connection between spiritual practice and meditation and Buddhist practice, and in terms of just how it plays out on a much larger scale, the way we relate to others in the world, the way we affect the world. I see that they're completely interrelated, and that what the Buddha called bhavanacitta, or meditation, is the foundation for a revolutionary change in not only the way we relate to our inner experience, but also the way we relate to the world around us. And it has far and wide implications. So, starting out with one of my favorite teachings by the Buddha, which is called the Atthadanda, and I'm going to read a little bit from it. I think it's really pretty amazing what he writes, or what he actually said. He didn't write it. It was memorized and years later written down. Basically, he says, when I looked at the world, I saw it filled with people who flounder like fish in little puddles. People fighting with one another over what scraps were left. And though everything is conditional and subject to change, I saw how everything is competed over and laid claim to. If one wants to find peace, one should renounce from feeding off of the world. The word feeding actually is upadana, and it's often translated as clinging. So you've probably heard that Buddhism, or attachment, that Buddhism is about non-attachment or non-clinging. But actually, from one perspective, and many of the suttas, the Buddha is really saying that it's about not consuming as much as we do. Not consuming the world, looking for our lasting happiness outside of ourselves. He, in the Eight Worldly Winds, he says that we look for lasting peace and happiness in acclaim from other people, from power, from sensual pleasures, from property, from money. We try to accumulate this stuff to make us feel better. But the problem is that the energy that fuels our craving actually starts with stress within. He actually teaches that the source of this feeding frenzy we're in, trying to get more and more things to make us feel secure and safe and happy, he says that actually the chain, if you follow it back, the feeding starts with craving for happiness and security, and what's behind that craving is stress. We're uncomfortable, what he called vedana dukkha. So if we look behind all of our addictive, obsessive compulsions, our needs, our quests, very often there's a very underlying stress that we're trying to distract ourselves from. In a sense, what so many of us engage in the world is we're engaging in a massive game of distraction. Because we feel there's something missing, or there's something empty, or there's something stressful inside. We're uncomfortable in our own skin. And when we feel this feeling, rather than going within and trying to relax it and see which thoughts are causing us the stress and see which physical contractions we can release, rather than going directly to the problem, we go for a band-aid. We go for a projection outside in the world that will distract us from feeling what's happening inside. And worse, there's a couple of results from this constant externalized distracting hunt for pleasures and securities that will make us feel differently inside. The first is that external things are conditional. If I'm getting my sense of happiness by getting acclaim from you guys, well, I'm making my happiness conditioned on you being in a good mood. You know, if I depend on my happiness with my boss or somebody I work with approving of my work, if they are in a bad mood that day, then my happiness is screwed. It's totally conditional. Also, what they found, every single clinical baseline happiness test shows that when we make our happiness contingent upon accumulation, we need more and more and more things to get the same initial result. So it's like an alcoholic who first gets relief from a couple of cans of beers and then within a few years needs bottles of Jameson's to do the same trick. It's the same thing with money. When a businessman gets a $1 million deal, the study showed the next deal has to be $10 million to get the same sense of self-esteem rush for a little while. So it's a game of habituation. We get bored. The new iPad looks really shiny for a little while, but then we need the iPad 2. And fuck the iPad 2. What about the iPad 3? And, you know. So we get bored quickly with external things. Why do we get bored? Because the problem's in here and those external things are out there. So eventually, wanting their shininess and their newness to make us feel good in here, we're going to get used to the shininess and the newness, and we're still going to have that underlying stress. And eventually, the underlying stress is going to pop through. So we're going to need more and more shiny things. Another result that's unfortunate is that we get into conflict with others. Because other people want the same acclaim, the same shiny objects, the same sensual pleasures, the same money. We're not alone when we want to find our happiness out there in the world. We're like what the Buddha called those fish fighting against each other for little bits of remaining food. And where we get into conflict, then what happens is we get feelings of anger with other people. It causes agitation. We get envious when other people get the shit that we were trying to get. That was my shit. And they got to my shit first. So, and when we experience conflict outside, unfortunately, it doesn't just stay outside. The human mind likes to believe that the things we do outside in the world don't affect inside and vice versa. We like to think that we could think secretively judgmental thoughts and it won't affect the way we relate to other people. Or vice versa, that we can go out on the job and be very competitive but come home and be relaxed and peaceful. But unfortunately, the attitudes we plant, the habits we store, and we store in the striatum, which is a region of the brain that determines our habitual thoughts and actions. They don't just stay in use in one area of our lives. They infect everything. If we are in conflict with the people around us, we will be in conflict with ourselves. If we judge the people around us, we will judge ourselves. If we fight or feel distant from others, then we will feel distant from parts of ourselves we don't like. There's no energy that we can feed that will not affect our entire experience. So this conflict we get into others causes internal turmoil and conflict. Finally, the Buddha talks about the result of this conflict and this feeding frenzy is what he calls intoxication. We, as the short-term release of buying something, you know, spending money on that credit card or eating or, you know, acclaim from people at work or heroin or alcohol, whatever it is we've been feeding off of for short-term relief, when it wears off, we're back in stress again. And the cycle shortens and it becomes quicker and it becomes this intoxicating cycle of what the Buddha terms samsara. We get the thing, we get relief, the relief fades, the stress returns, we're back in the craving and the feeding. It's a cycle. And the more we're caught up in this cycle of hunting for our security and our careers, hunting for our sense of purpose or identity, who am I in my job or in my art or in my family? When I'm doing all this, when I'm putting it all out there, what I don't notice is that that's becoming my entire life. In Buddhism, much like existentialism, the Buddha maintained that there's no real purpose we're born with. I know Christians believe we're born with a purpose. But actually, the Buddha, much like Sartre and the existentialists, believe that our existence precedes our essence. In other words, we're born, and pretty much the only cause we have in our life is just to keep the species going along. Fucking die. Basically, that's what it boils down to. That's not very much of a real purpose. So what the Buddha said is what the meaning of our life is what we do in our life. How we spend our life becomes the meaning of our life. There's no secret meaning for life waiting for us to find. Whatever you're doing with your life, that's the meaning of your life. So if it's an addictive spiral, if it's just a constant hunting for meaning outside of ourselves, yeah, when I climb up this career table to the pinnacle, or when I make the perfect painting, or write the perfect short story, or whatever, then I'll have accumulated a real meaning. These are worthwhile endeavors. Oh, I'm giving my best stuff. So that's nice. That's the thing about searching for happiness from like attention and acclaim from others. There's always you're never going to get it. So basically. It becomes intoxicating. We become trapped in this cyclical, you know, and we don't notice that life's slipping by, that we're aging, that there's another source of happiness available that we haven't been paying attention to. Years can pass by and we can be completely unaware of just how much stress we're carrying around in our body, or just how unnecessary so many of our thoughts are, just how much mental agitation our thoughts of competition and jealousy and envy and, you know, keeping track of slights and resentments towards others. We become so caught up in the external game that we're unaware of just the toll that's being taken inside. So what the Buddha proposes is a revolutionary realignment. What he's saying basically is there are requisites to what we need to survive. We all need some clothing, some shelter, we need food, we need medicine, we need probably enough work to stay in a house. But beyond that, once we can discern what's enough for us to have a good foundation, to turn the project at least partially inwards, to start becoming aware of the stuff inside that we haven't been looking at, these old sadnesses that we haven't paid attention to, these old experiences in life that we've yet to give our witnessing to open ourselves to needs that we haven't explored, to open ourselves to just what it's like inside, and to notice, like, to take a kind of inventory, what kind of thoughts are passing through my mind that I'm not noticing? What are my intentions? Am I always acting out of intentions from fear? Or am I acting occasionally out of intentions that are courageous and compassionate and appreciative? So often when we're caught up in pushing through the world to try to get to our jobs and get through our jobs and get home, other people become obstacles, and we're just trying to get past them, and our thinking becomes, oh, why is this person in my way? Why is that person walking so slow? Why is the person walking behind me so fast? Why is that person blocking that subway door? Why is this? So it's just everything becomes an obstacle. And when everything becomes an obstacle, we feel walled in. We feel that the space we have in life shrinks, because we're no longer relating to the world as something that we sympathize with or feel compassion towards. We're relating to the world as something that we're in competition with. So when we start and we have a practice that's based on, first, on a daily basis, just trying to find some of that relief within, that undercuts that feeding frenzy, that cuts the legs off of that constant, I've got to get it from you. When people often find themselves in a series of unrewarding relationships, it's almost always because they don't notice how much stress and loneliness and sadness they haven't explored within. And so when they get into a relationship, they want the other person to fill up that sadness, that loneliness, that sense of emptiness. And the other person goes, whoa. I didn't sign up for this. I thought this was a first date. I didn't know that or a second date. I didn't know this was filling up an empty childhood and a distant father and an uncaring mother, and, you know. But people can tell, even unconsciously, when we're trying to get from them more than they're prepared to give, when we're demanding more than they have to offer. So how do we undercut that demand? We undercut it within by opening to all those hurts and those feelings of incompleteness and losses that we haven't truly mourned. Rather than distracting ourselves out there so that we don't have to feel it, we really go through the feelings. We really mourn if we had a distant parent and we didn't feel supported, then we feel those feelings. And when we feel them, that we don't need somebody to give us something that will cover that wound over. We've actually healed that wound. So we're no longer trying to fix ourselves with the world. The job is inside. And once we start doing that, then we also start, other things start happening. Rather than getting caught up in thoughts of envy and competition, we start, what the Buddha said, we start practicing thoughts that we see are much more peaceful and pleasant. We start practicing compassion for others and for ourselves. Appreciation for when other people experience joy rather than the competition of envy. Because we realize the more we stay inside that that envy and competition and jealousy and feeling that it's me against the world is the most uncomfortable, stressful thoughts that keep the cycle going of suffering. And if I really want to be peaceful inside, not only do I relax and feel the feelings that need to be felt, but I start replacing the thoughts that are causing me suffering with thoughts that are bringing me lasting happiness, a sense of no longer being bounded in by the world, but feeling an open heart towards the world, such as appreciation for others' happiness and compassion when others are feeling or suffering. It's a sense, really, of just experiencing how different these thoughts and intentions play out in our own internal experience. And then, even further, when we really start to do this work and we have a sense of what's enough, not all the things we want, but just what's enough to be comfortable enough in our lives, we get a sense of what the Buddha called when it's time to renounce, when it's time to let go. Sometimes the amount of effort that goes into getting any satisfaction from a certain job or from a certain relationship, a certain friend, is just too much work. And we begin to see, wow, I've been really barking up a tree that's not going to be, you know, going to have any rewards to it. We can really begin to see which jobs and relationships and situations are just stressful and not bringing us anything other than distractions, but are not healing anything. And I think this approach radically just transforms then the way we we view the world, how much we view the world, how much we turn obsessively to the news and stuff like that. We feel much less vulnerable when we have a center within. We feel much less need when we have a center within. And while it sounds like, oh my God, you're saying we have to live, it's best to live with a little less, but actually, in my experience, when I do let go of, like, instead of getting what I want, instead just choosing to have what I need, that actually the things that I really need, I really cherish. If you've ever seen a Buddhist monk with his bowl, it's amazing. It's fucking amazing. They cherish and they polish these bowls and they look so beautiful, you think that each bowl was worth untold millions. They're just beautiful objects. And they crochet these elaborate bowl carriers. And their robes, even though they just have simple robes, they learn how to, you know, spin it around them in a way that looks really fucking hip. And I've never seen one of the fuckers doing anything but smiling. And they live in like their little cooties, which have like a window, and if they have like, you know, they might have one or two outlets where they'll have like a hot plate, and some of them will have a computer and a laptop and a very low mat. But their days are incredibly happy because they're not spent all their time just hunting out in the world for ways to feel better in here. They're just engaged with us in the world enough that they take care of the necessary business. But inside, they are so at peace, they walk like they're levitating. That's the sound they make. They're hovering 2 inches above the ground. Yeah, so it's actually like it's actually a profoundly revolutionary approach to the way we live. When we start meditating and we start really finding happiness within, before we know it, it completely affects, and we start seeing, we start becoming aware of like our addictions really clearly, and the thoughts that are causing us harm. I don't ever crave very much, but I have an addiction to hoodies. It's just embarrassment. And I'm so aware of it. Every time, like, I'm not in intoxication where I'm just, I gotta buy some clothes to, you know, I just gotta, I have a tough day, let me, you know, have a drink and some a hoodie. And, it's like every time I'm acting out, I'm like really aware, oh shit, I'm acting out again on this fucking hoodie thing. It's like, so even when we're not ready to give up something, there's this real clarity there. We're not like being driven anymore. We're like, here comes the donut fix, you know, here comes the whatever. So it becomes a shining light of discernment and wisdom in our life. The more we turn inwards, feel, relax, find peace, and also act skillfully, compassionate with our fellows, and change thoughts from competitive and resentful to peaceful and forgiving, then we have this very, very clear light to start seeing everything we do in terms of, wow, is this really bringing me lasting happiness? Or is this just one more distraction that's not going to bring me long-term happiness? So anyway, that's tonight's talk. I think that's about it. Hope you got something from it. I think